my colleagues is taking a Georgia Tech course right now in computer science at the master's level, and he's being given libraries. Basically, he's being given C++ libraries that are broken, that don't work, and they're supposed to work, you know. And, you know, he's saying, what the hell is programming in C++? Why are we doing this? And, you know, any number of things. R, Python, any of those other more modern languages that are, should we say, either, you know, more functional scripts, script type languages, or big data manipulators, you know, for that kind of stuff. So it's frustrating. So he had to write his own libraries, and then he published them to other places just for his fellow students to use, because it was ridiculous. It's an online course he's taking. It's just stupid. So Dick, I'm thinking that there's still that academic, thought of you have to, they run a survival school, you know, it's got to be sort of like going to BUD if you're going to be a Navy SEAL. It's kind of ridiculous. When you ask, you know, why is it that we need to know all the, let's say go back to the waves, fields and waves course, the Maxwell's equations, things like that, that they'll tell you with snobbery, we're not running a trade school. Well, hell bells, but the amount of money that needs to be, and what you're trying to...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Oh dear, I'm sorry.
Your time was perfect. Go ahead and finish your statement.
Yeah, I said at the end is that, the academy, and, you know, they put these committees together in the school. Well, they also put these committees together, for the certification bodies to credential, degree programs. And so that same kind of, poor representation is done there. But, they'll tell you you have to, for fields and waves and plenty of other courses, you need to do this, because they're not running a trade school. Well, you know what? If you can't make a buck to pay for the education, it's now going to cost you, if you're lucky, a couple $100,000, if you want to go the whole circuit. And that's on the discount plan in some cases. You damn well better be running a trade school, because otherwise, what are you producing? Anyway. I think we're about to see a real rupture in traditional academia, and more information is going to be available online. People are going to get stuff done through online training, everything from Audacity to Khan Academy, even going down to the grammar school level, is changing the way academics are being rendered, which is a good thing. Anyway, I'll listen a couple of go-rounds, and I got to switch gears here, and I got to just be on monitor only. K2RWW2TGT.
Intuition of another subject.
Quick comment on the topic.
Yeah, Gordon, thank you for the information. In the case of computer science, engineering science, there is feedback going on. Each school wants to make sure that their course is current, because each high school kid says, I want to do computers. And I'm going to choose a school that's well-respected in that area, and it's up to the latest and greatest, whether it be language, hardware, software, firmware, whatever. So it is adapting. And the adaptation in the area you and I are talking about right now absolutely doesn't exist. The head of the electrical engineering department of the school I went to was a man who got his doctorate degree, left school, went to work for Bell Laboratories for either 2 or 3 years, didn't like industry, went back to teaching. So think about that. I'm now being acclimated for an industry by a man who's the head of the department who could not acclimate himself to that industry. He couldn't create a fit between what he knew, what he teaches, and what they needed. Craziness. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, you're absolutely right. I was told the same thing when I entered my first year of school, that, like, look around, this guy isn't going to be with you at all. Wound up, the hard number is 17% graduated with that discipline. Others transferred, did whatever they did, but only 17%. And I don't know what percentage of the 17% actually went into the field. I wish I could find that out. It might not be everybody. Another thing, along with what you were saying before about how you taught two mechanical engineers how to basically be an antenna engineer. Yes, that can be done. They're bright people, but they will not be innovative. And if they are, it'll be at a very minor level. They're not going to accomplish something like what you did. And, I mean, that's unique.
I'll take exception to that. What do you mean by you'll take exception to that? Go ahead, go ahead.
Okay, I swear with no degree at all, zip nada, and I'm a principal technical architect at AT&T, now the MTS and Bell Labs, ATT Labs, before they changed all their titles around. I go through this cycle all the time. I've got patent applications for patents, granted patents and applications for patents, for things that are highly innovative, and so I'm not buying that interdisciplinary or lack of academic background in a particular area makes you non-innovative. I don't think so. I got, 40 pending patent applications, 30 granted patents, just otherwise.
Bill Gates didn't have a college degree. What's the name of the man who headed Apple? He passed away recently. He didn't have a college degree. There are people who are very productive, very innovative, who didn't but do it by way of college. Nowadays, by way of the internet, you can get a tremendous amount of information on any subject. And 98% of it's good stuff. It can be a little bit selective sometimes, but there's lots and lots of ways of getting information, education in your favorite area. And if you're smart, you're going to try to choose an occupation that you enjoy. The saddest situation of all is a guy who goes to work every day saying, I hate my job. I do it because I have no choice. I'll starve if I don't do this. The ideal situation is choose something you like, that you have a passion for, find a way of being good at it, and now you can have fun every day and be paid for it. To some degree, I think I almost succeeded in doing that. Almost. I didn't become rich quick, but I lived reasonably well and enjoyed it. In fact, my last work assignment as a consultant, I worked for 10 solid years, every single day, for a particular company as a consultant. Yes, I was offered full-time employment, but I wanted the freedom. And so, of all the consultants, I'm a member of the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network. Let me drop. And the majority of those consultants will work on a consulting job for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks. The job is over, and they go out and seek another one. I worked for the same company for 10 solid years, every single day. I didn't even take vacation. Craziness. I was having that much fun. And I didn't even work regular hours. I showed up when the spirit moved me. And they were willing to tolerate that, because they needed a certain kind of antenna engineering, and the kinds of antennas they needed. They went out for bids to all of the major companies in the United States. They all no bid, saying that can't be done. Well, there's a few of those now being shipped. A few individual designs of those things that can't be done, where companies all no bid them. Half the companies they went out to didn't even respond, and the ones that did respond, no bid. And you go back to the ones that didn't respond and say, why not? And they say, you guys are crazy. Yeah, we could do a laboratory curiosity. We could tweak one real carefully and meet your specifications, but we'll never get any yield on that. We'll never be able to make a profit. By way of their modeling programs on that particular design requirement, to some degree, they were right. They're stuck in the paradigm. They're led to believe the schools these days will teach you that computer modeling is everything, whether it's computational fluid dynamics, whether it's mechanics, no matter what, you're led to believe that computer modeling is everything. And for 98% of the areas, maybe that's right. But there's a whole area where, for the time being, it is not right. And no one will accept that. They've all heard another story for a whole lot of years. They believe it, and they believe it's the only answer. I've got to write some articles. I've had a number of bids from people who want me to give speeches on this particular subject. I've got to put it all into a set of view graphs. And the beginning of those view graphs, I'm going to have to show them the pictures of the jobs that I've worked on, the pictures of the full-size antennas on chambers and on antenna testing pedestals or whatever. I'll have to show them that this is where the radical information you're about to hear, where did it come from? You've got two choices. You're either going to say the guy who's talking to you right now is crazy, or with all of this as a background, maybe there's something here. Anybody got any further questions or comments? K2RIW.
Got an update on Kepler.
Okay, yeah. What did you say about Kepler? I heard Gordon, and then John in that order. Gordon first. Go ahead, Gordon.
You can back so snarky to the other station, so forgive me. bear with me. It's just it's a raw nerve thing. But it works out very, very well, and I've been very blessed. Dick, I think, hit the nail on the head. If you are having fun doing something you're passionate about, and there's a lot of things I'm passionate about, which is another gift in itself, can sometimes, you know, it either can make you a Renaissance man or can make you highly scattered, depending on how you manage it. But I was that high school freshman who, I guess it was the junior year of my high school year, I was horrified, or maybe the sophomore year, that I was horrified when QST went to the large format, because then when I was in a class that was boring and I was already ahead of the curve on it, I couldn't hide my QST or my ham radio magazine or my 73 inside. But what I was doing in high school, I was reading articles by guys like K2RIW. And I was dating a girl whose father was Harry Karp, who is the founding editor of Data Communications Magazine. So I had a passing interest in telecommunications and digital things, all things digital as well. And that served me well. I knew how to do teletype, and eventually wanted to use a computer only to basically put signals on the moon and lock my contacts and tell me where the moon was. You know, that was about it. So it was kind of neat. I kind of backed my way into computers kind of after high school while I was in and out of college. But the point is this, that you have to be passionate, you have to be willing to study, learning has to be a lifelong experience. I think that's the fundamental modeling problem.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Those kinds of skills. So why don't we just take some bright kids right out of high school and put them into engineering apprentice programs. You know, make them do field engineering, make them do, you know, repairs, make them do bench work, learn how to manufacturing process or whatever processes are germane to the build to the business, you know, the operating of the phone company or telecommunications company, learn how to operate and stuff, and incorporate academics into that process over a longer period of time. And after 10 years, you'll have something better than we have 10 years from high school graduation today. And by the way, the person paid their way earned their way to that, not just shelled out endless amounts of money. So, something to think about. K2RAW and the group. I'll make this my last, but I'm listening. W2TTT. Thank you for your patience.
Into it, Shane.
Had a quick break. all of a sudden, I've forgotten your name. Gordon. Did you do moon bounce? It sounded like you were very interested in moon bounce. Did you manage to do some moon bounce?
I did. In the late 70s, I did. My biggest problem was not being able to elevate, but I had five-element quads, wide-space quads, and they ultimately, courtesy of Wayne Overbeck, it influence became quads just because they were easier to maintain. And I was able to do it, and made a couple of contacts, nothing major, and I did it one or two times to get to hear my own echoes, which was kind of neat too, but boy, that was brutal. On 2 meters, by the way, so it's all good. I had a pair of 4CX300s that were running, they were 4CN15s that W2AZL, W2NCF, and a third guy from Bell Labs had built. I got the third guy's amplifier. I had to build a new power supply for a high V supply for it, but and put air on it. But once I did that, I was getting a ridiculous amount of power out of a quote pair of 15W2s.
And were you running a W2AZL low noise amplifier on 2 meters?
Yeah.
I kind of thought so. Go ahead, John, with your comment.
417 amp, right? Mr. Amp?
That's the one. 416 was the Cadillac version of that. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. I finally got the coupler apart. 26 Allen head screws. I've never seen the inside of one like this. It is a strip line, and it has gold foil for the conductor, and evidently it was dropped or something. Although the case doesn't have any marks on it, the strip line is broken right at the end connector input, so that is it.
Now you and I know why it failed the ohm meter test. So in other words, it apparently experienced so many vertical G's against that flat surface that the strip line, which is air suspended strip line, I'm guessing, got ripped away from the type N connector on one end. How big a gap was that? I imagine it was a very small gap. Is that true?
Oh, about a 32nd of an inch, maybe a 64th. It's very small. And no, it's mounted on Teflon. And the Teflon has a special coating on it. The gold strip is laid down on that. Then on the piece that mates with it, there's another piece of Teflon that has a green stripe on it that sits directly over that. Whether that's a capacitive device or what, I have no idea. But that is it. And a lot of gold in this thing. All the finger stock is gold. And it's not like copper-plated gold. It's gold. So good stuff. But this will be an easy fix.
Take some pictures of that, John. Let me check on something here. Okay, yeah. I'm glad to see that the Eastern repeater came back. Take some pictures of that. Why, in your opinion, was the case so beefy and heavy for a relatively simple strip line 20 dB coupler? And does the strip line, is the coupled line completely parallel, or is there steps to its distance? Go ahead.
Okay, the coupled line, the straight through line goes from end connector to end connector, from one end to the other, straight, flat, and glued down on the Teflon. The coupled cords come from the same side, they come in vertically, then that gold foil is twisted at a right angle, and it's about an inch and a quarter long, and that is secured to the same piece of Teflon, about a quarter of an inch away from, and both of them are identical, except one is on this side, or the base side of the Teflon, the other port is on the other side of the Teflon.
Strange. The coupled line that is parallel to the straight through line, that parallel section, roughly how many inches long is it, John?
Let me grab it here. 1 second. About an inch and 3/8.
That doesn't sound like a quarter wavelength. I think you said this is from 500 megs to 1,000. Is that a frequency?
2 gig.
Oh, 1 to 2 gig. Okay. Okay. 2 gig, I guess, is in the vicinity of a 4-inch wavelength, quarter wave. Huh. Sounds a little bit short, but is it a curve of performance on the cover?
Yes, there is. Hold on, let me get it.
Is it relatively flat from 1 to 2 gigs?
I'm going to look at it right now.
Yeah, Brady took that apart. From what you were telling me, it sounded like you really had to take it apart. It's a beautiful instrument, but not in the form it was in. It's not useful to you then. Isn't it amazing how little information there is in the whole world of electronics on directional couplers, how in the world has this beautiful, high-performance, passive component given so little emphasis in all of the stuff that we can read and hear about? I'm amazed that this thing was everybody's poor off and nobody gave it any emphasis at all.
Well, at 1.5 gig, it's approximately, I would say 19 dB. Now when it gets up to 2 gig, hold on a second, it's almost 21 dB.
So it is a 20 dB coupler, plus or minus 1 dB, across that whole region of 1 to 2 gigs. That's a good spec.
And both ports have relatively the same markings on the calibration.
And I think you said it's a dual directional coupler. Does that mean that there are...
And both coupled ports have about the same frequency response.
So it's got two separate coupled lines. One is north of the straight-through line, one is south of the straight-through line. Is that the way they did it, John?
No, they're both north.
Okay. If they're both on the same side of the straight-through line, how do they both have the exact same spacing from the straight-through line without interfering with each other?
All right, let's look at the through port is left to right. Both couple ports come out of the top at right angles to the main line, and they're at the extreme ends of the coupler.
Okay, the coupled lines inside, the portion of the coupling, has to be parallel to the straight-through line. Because it's a dual directional coupler, you've got a pair of coupled lines. How are the coupled lines arranged compared to the straight-through line? Are they both on the same, both the same spacing? If you know, is this spaced in the same direction? Over to you, John.
No, if you were looking at the left coupler, it comes down at right angles. It makes a right turn, goes to the right along the through line. The coupler on the right comes down at a right angle and goes to the left. But the coupler on the right, that couple port, is on the opposite side of the Teflon substrate.
Okay, I think I'm getting the impression that the straight-through line is so darn long that near the beginning is where one of the couplers is located, near the end is where the other coupler is located. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Aha. Now I'm catching on. That's a nice design. And by those right-angle bends, the output connectors come through the front and back face, whereas the left-hand face and the right-hand face are the straight-through ports. Is that roughly true?
That's correct. It's correct. It's the straight-through port, which runs along its longitude, is connected from one end connector to another in a straight fashion, and only the coupled ports come down at right angles on opposite sides of the substrate and in opposite directions.
What do the 50-ohm internal terminations look like? Do they look like three-dimensional blobs of black material?
No, that's the difficult thing to see. One, when the cover comes off, it's under the Teflon, whatever that termination is, the 50 ohms. Now, the other one is where, from the lid that goes down, there's a gold finger from another piece of strip line, another piece of Teflon that runs the full length of the element, and evidently the 50 ohms is in there somewhere.
You got to take some pictures of this thing, John. This sounds like a very unique coupler. I don't think I've ever heard of one quite like this. What color is the outside package and its label?
HB blue.
For the whole package. And is the label red?
No, it's HP, it's all blue.
Yeah, you gotta take some pictures of this.
Take some pictures and shots like I did on the other one, and I'll send them over to you.
Fantastic. Here we go. Wes, go right ahead. K2LAW.
And take Shane. I'd like to bring a subject that is somehow related to the space report. The exposure to increased level of cosmic ionizing radiation in aviation, also in the space travel, or the earth level of 10 miles to 70 miles. I wonder if you have something interesting in this area, Andresian.
I don't. I know that the astronauts, when they went through the Van Allen belt, were very happy about the fact that when they went to the moon, they went through the Van Allen belt very fast. They dwelled there very little time. A human being dwelling there would not be happy. In the case of the International Space Station, the International Space Station is walking a very narrow line. If they were any higher up in altitude, their orbital path would have a much slower decay. That's the good news. The bad news is they would be greater, deeper into the Van Allen belt, and the astronauts would be bathed in a lot more radiation. So they got to keep them low enough to be out of the Van Allen belt, but high enough that they're not getting a lot of atmospheric drag. So they walk a very narrow line. And so they can't be any lower without getting a lot of drag. They can't be any higher without being cooked. So that Van Allen belt is not good. I know that there's been multiple studies, let me drop it, saying that if we do decide to send human beings to Mars, they're going to be spending a significant amount of time outside of the Earth's magnetic field. That Earth's magnetic field does an awful lot of shielding of high-speed particles, charged particles that would come toward us. It's a beautiful deflection device. Without the Earth's magnetic field, the solar wind would have been peeling away our atmosphere. Because Mars lost its magnetic field, that's the major explanation as to why Mars lost its atmosphere. The solar wind peeled it away. So, and there's been quite a few articles lately about the fact that there's some real potent cosmic rays, gamma rays, and whatever, coming to the Earth from time to time, that are apparently coming from a very massive source of some kind, and not easy to explain how they arrive at such high energy levels, many, many times above what you can do with the Large Hadron Collider. Over to US, K2LAW.
And to explain, well, there is a very interesting subject, because the exposure to cosmic ionizing radiation in aviation is pretty much important. As an example, if you have a 5-13 hours cross polar flight from New York to Tokyo on the single round trip during the solar storm, you already exceeded the maximum recommended levels of annual radiation dose for general public. And those roads are extremely intense right now because of the fuel saving and all of the commercial politics that is applied to the air traffic. So there is a concern about cosmic radiation exposure and integrated effective dose, say, for neutrons and protons and X-rays and gamma radiation is important at the altitudes over 10 kilometers, which would be what, 1.7 kilometer. So there is another factor, and that is that approximately half of that radiation is due to the neutron radiation. So one hazard of neutron radiation is the neutron activation, which is the ability of the neutron radiation to induce radioactivity in most substances it encounters, including the body tissues of workers themselves. And it was an interesting study that says that there is a very high cancer risk for the people who work in the aviation as a pilot, but also in the into the frequent flyers of it. Do you have something about in this area?
Now, I don't have any smarts in this area, but my first question would be, if during a solar prominence, if you're on a flight that goes over the North Pole, or near the North Pole, so to speak, to go from the United States to Japan, and the Great Circle Path, that's the shortest possible path, and if on one of those flights you're getting the recommended maximum exposure, if a pilot is going to fly that route day in and day out, it sounds like he's going to exceed, that he's going to accumulate an amount of exposure that's well above recommendation. I wonder, do they rotate those pilots? Do they keep track of what their exposure is? Do they wear an exposure badge? What do we know about what those pilots and air crew are experiencing? Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
Actually, what I've read is five flights, five front flights. Third would be if we deal with a pilot who is flying to Tokyo, just in, say, five flights would be approximately 10 days. He cannot fly any longer. 65 epidemiological studies find that elevated radiation caused breast cancer in female air crew members and of the melanoma I'm reading right now in both male and female air crew. Estimated annual exposure to the air crews equals, if not exceeds, the allowable limits for the average nuclear power plant worker. So, we're dealing with much more dangerous job. Frequent flyer business passenger are more likely to be exposed to even higher doses than the air crew, because flight hours are not excuses for the passengers. I have some solution for that that we'll find by science, but first, back to you.
Okay, you say you've got a solution for this. I know that the astronauts on the cosmonauts, the astronauts on the International Space Station, when they know they're going to get a high exposure, they go and hide in the most massive section of the International Space Station. But I think the amount of shielding they're getting is rather minor. Shielding from this is very difficult. Over to U.S.
Yes, that's in the area of shielding. It's pretty much known shield for the neutron radiation, which takes half of the risk of the people up there, is water. Then another one is trihalon glycol, and that's if it's absorbed by the air liquid, then another one is a various numbers of plastic, and that would be acting as a moderator. So in some cases it's gonna be slowing down the fast neutrons, but in some other cases will be just reflecting them. So that would be, but this is not the end of it. The polyethylene, but we have a different number, different types of polyethylene. There is one that is high density polyethylene, HDPE, which is not very good one. It does have a long chain, a high pressure structure, but there is a one that is low density polyethylene LDPE, and that one is widely used in power plants, nuclear power plants, but also in many of the nuclear labs. And there is a whole science that is related to something that is being called SRN, spectacular reflection of neutrons from surfaces. what they rather try to do instead of increasing the volume, which concrete is the good one, the reflector of the neutrons. So you could not imagine you to put into the spacecraft concrete. They rather try to deal with the thin films of silicon and then water solution and the Teflon base, and rather try to have a collimation of possible part of the neutrons that would come from an angle, and that will create the total reflection. However, there is a problem with that, because when you are in the aircraft, you cannot really foresee from which angle the string of the neutron or cosmic radiation will come. And there is a new science that is directed to a different kind of materials that would be able to absorb this radiation. Enter again.
When it comes to high power penetrating particles, high velocity penetrating particles, up till now I've had the impression that the only way you can stop them is to put a lot of mass between you and them. And whether that mass is made out of steel, lead, water, or anything else doesn't make a lot of difference, is what I used to think. If I put a certain number of kilograms of material between me and the source of that radiation, I get a certain amount of shielding. Does it really matter what I use to make up that mass? Would I get a difference with concrete versus lead versus water if I kept the mass the same? Over US, K2RIW.
So this is what the science is trying to do. He's trying to make mass unimportant. That's why they start to deal with the thin films and the multi-layer coating for eventually the spacecraft, or the coating of the aircraft. So they were at first dealing with the angle of incidence, trying to see whether the shape of the aircraft or the shape of the material, that would not necessarily be a coating, but rather at the angle in between the size, in between the coating, would make a difference. And there is one very interesting approach. So for you to easily understand, let's say we want to approach the material at the angle of 15 degrees. But now we have that material lying on the top of the aircraft, and we don't know really what that variation gonna come from, but most likely we see that on the top of the aircraft, we might see that there's the string of the neutrons. So now what they try to do is create in within the layer, angularly place sort of the layers of the material that would be at, say, 15 degrees to the potential neutron radiation. And then nanotubes came into the picture. In between the nanotubes, there is a material that is being called boron nitride and boron nitride nanotube materials for the radiation shielding. And before they get into it, there were a number of experiments, and actually part of that came from the amateurs, not radio amateurs. Because they were at first playing with polonium beryllium neutron source, which is easy to obtain stuff, and there was a full research which could translate some of the polyethylene material used as a moderator, and see if eventually they're going to get any concentration of the neutron, which will stay about not about absorption by the material of the neutron, but rather the reflection, because they can have no place to go, only to reflect.
Yeah, hold on a second, Wes. The Eastern repeater is working, John, so why do you think we should go to a complete reset? Are we losing something with reference to EchoLink, KC2WGB, K2LAW?
It's possible, Dick. I just wanted to let it reset, so it'll only take a second.
Yeah, I think whenever the Eastern link is working, I think the Echo link is also working. Or am I being a little bit naive on that one? Back to you, John.
I believe I got a message here from Eric, which was claiming the transmission was too long, and I saw that come up, and I just wanted to give it a shot, make sure that it is up and working.
Yeah, we did have a dropout 20 minutes or so ago of the Eastern link, but it has been restored, maybe by Eric. Okay, we got about 3.5 minutes left. Go ahead, Wes. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yeah, the typical absorbers are water polyethylene, paraffin, wax, and concrete. But where the considerable amounts of water molecules are chemically bound to the cement and do the neutron attenuation, and say hydrogen is not necessarily the best solution, then the material that is made of boron and nanotubes actually being extremely thin presents right now one of the highest levels of reflection, not absorption, reflection of the cosmic particles. It's kind of puzzling me because when we talk about the cosmic particles, we're talking about something that has different wavelength. And also we're talking about the particles that are mass and massless. And it is found that that material is somehow universal answer for that. And to issue it. Okay, so that would be probably everything about that. Some things to add since we have a minute. Boron containing nanomaterial polymer is synthesized from boron containing, actually, it's a certain matrix that is controlled by dispersion of the boron with the nanomaterial in matrix, and that's what makes high reflectability. So that would be the solution for all of space travel and air travel. Thank you very much. Okay, John?
Yeah, sorry, I got called away for a minute. The boron nitride sounds like a very tough material. Also, carbon nanotubes are also an extremely tough material. I think you're saying carbon nanotubes or sheets of graphene. Are they capable of being a good reflector? What do you think, Wes?
Actually, it's a mixture of them.
So a mixture is better than just the carbon graphene material itself, is what I think you're saying. In other words, it makes it sound like the particles are able to go between the matrix of the carbon graphene material.
That is correct. In other words, in typical applications, there was a layering. They were trying to use say, silicon as a first layer solution, which could be a water or anything that is another layer, and then Teflon, which would be the another one. That was the very much typical practice on it. Although you cannot imagine yourself that you're going to put a solution in liquid form into the coating of the airplane. But for many other applications, especially in nuclear plants, that was very much present. And to exchange.
So it sounds like these new materials give you better shielding than just counting up the amount of mass. Sounds good. This was TechNet number 1529 of the series. It began way back in September of 1982. John and I will, and the crew will be back next week. Try to be kind to each other. Back over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Very good, Dick. Good net. And I want to thank everybody for participating. And keep the email questions coming. More than glad to handle them. So everybody have a great week. We shall be back Sunday, more than likely.
Another Sunday in New York.
Oh, is that where I am?
Aren't you in one of the five boroughs? A borough, isn't that a beast of burden?
Being here is like being on a beast of burden, that's for sure.
The time is 12:01 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
Transmission is clean. Maybe it's mine.
No, it's not you, because it's there when you're not transmitting.
True. Didn't think of that. So how was your weekend?
Very nice, very nice. I did the Hope for the Warriors race yesterday with Great South Bay.
I did some much-needed sleep yesterday, and then I caught up on some paperwork. And then Sunday night, when Sonny Boy got off work, we went out to dinner, the three of us, and he wouldn't let me touch the check.
All those hundreds of thousands of dollars you spent on him over the years, and it's all paying off. That's cool. That's classy. I like that.
He pulled the check away from me while I was reaching for my wallet and said, "You take me out to dinner enough. I can pick up this one occasionally." I didn't fight him.
I'm sure you felt proud. Oh, I just remembered what it is.
Something you can talk about on the radio, or you'll clue me in some other time?
Don't ask me why, but when I have the rear window electric defogger on in this vehicle, it does something to the receiver.
How close is the wiring for the rear window defogger to either your transmission line or your antenna itself?
Doesn't matter. It's something that happens once in a blue moon, and I'm like, what's going on with my radio? And then I realize it when I'm listening to the radio, and I went, oh, let me turn up the rear window defogger, and all of a sudden it goes away, and I go, oh yeah, I keep forgetting about it. I guess it's just the electric current or whatever that's running through the glass just does something to the antenna mounted on the trunk. So, no big deal. Solved the problem. See that? Simplest answer is usually the best answer. And to be in mobile.
And to Zeddy B Mobile, exiting the four-laner into the three-laner. I got something similar to that on... Oh, and there's a major brake check as soon as you enter the three-laner. I got something similar to that in this vehicle when I turn on the rear windshield wipers.
You get that electric motor noise permeates the radio?
Yeah, I get that. But I know why the antenna lead and the wires to the electric motor are right next to each other, going through the same body sleeve.
All right. Well, at least I don't have to troubleshoot anything in the vehicle. Put new tires on her. I'm in the Toyota. I think Wednesday. I don't remember I've spoken to you. Wednesday afternoon on my way home from work. Well, remember I had said last week that I saw the steel belt stick peeking out on the tire, so I swapped it with the spare?
Yeah, and then that spare decided to give you a problem also. So you said you were going to buy four new ones. You were waiting for them to be delivered UPS.
Yeah, yes. Two new ones. The rears were fine. So they came on, I ordered them, I guess what, Wednesday afternoon? They came Thursday afternoon, I believe. It was like super fast. I'm like, oh my God, they're here. They actually came from Latham, New York, which is just below Lake George, upstate, straight up. And I went on Saturday morning and got them put on old Pete here. And Pete's riding like a brand new vehicle now with two new front shoes. Man, is he happy.
It doesn't make sense to me, but I saw a sign in one of the tire places once a while ago that if you're replacing just two tires, and everyone always replaces them in pairs, the new tires should always go on the rear, even if it's a front-wheel drive vehicle. And it still doesn't make sense to me.
So the sign too, it's an STS. Their claim is that with the reduced tread in the rear, better tread in the front, you'll have a tendency to fishtail because of the reduced tread in the back. And I'm like, yeah, all right, well, that's all fun and nice, except this is an all-wheel drive vehicle, and the fronts are the ones that have all the weight on them, and those are the ones that wear out first.
Yep. That's the way they explained it, and it still doesn't make sense to me that you're going to fishtail because you got, oh, maybe. Doesn't matter. I still want to be able to pull through it. I usually end up replacing all four tires at once because I do the rotation so they do wear evenly.
It's nothing like rotating, I guess.
I think maybe over the winter, but definitely by the summer I'll probably have to change these tires. I can't believe I'm getting the wear I have. I've got a 113,000 on the car, and I'm only on my second set of tires.
I could have bought 90,000 mile tires for this vehicle. 90,000 miles tread wear warranty. The UTOG number was something like a 900. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. What are those things, solid rubber? The only problem with it is that in order to be able to take advantage of 90,000 mile tread life warranty, you gotta have a vehicle that doesn't wind up, you know, eating tires because it's got a camber issue on one of the struts.
And that's probably why you had the cord steel belts showing through. I'll bet that was the tire.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know what the deal is. I know what the situation is. The camber is off because the camber is fixed to the struts. You can't adjust caster and camber. You can only adjust toe. And it is what it is. So rather than sit there and try and do some kind of gorilla stuff to the frame of the vehicle or the struts to try and get the camber back in, I just watch the tires, and when I see the steel belt sticking out, it's time to replace them.
I do not know exactly what the condition of what's causing that strut issue. Is it framework on where the strut housing goes, or could replacement of the strut solve the problem?
The struts have a fixed angle value. They only go in one way. There are no shims or anything that you can do to the struts to change any of the values. So whether or not it's an ancient issue from when my parents owned the car, and I kind of remember my dad getting into a little something, and it might have thrown the camber off by a couple of degrees on that side, who knows? But you know what? Everything else works. Everything else goes. And as long as I don't let it get too crazy, it's well manageable and controllable. I mean, you know, hey, let's get serious. I'm not going to turn around and start doing framework to a 200,000-mile vehicle.
Well, that's the reason why I asked. Could it be the frame of the vehicle, or is it the strut itself that's off? In any case, I'm opposite the repeater site, but traffic's flowing nicely, by the way.
Do you just enjoy jinxing things?
I love living dangerously.
Okay. Doesn't matter to me. I'm like, Right behind you. I'm just rolling past Lakeville.
Sure, be like that.
Good morning, Steven.